It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe.
If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning. I'd a hammer in the evening. Over this land, I'd a hammer out of danger. I'd a hammer out of warning. I'd a hammer out of love between my brothers and my sisters. Oh.
Yarrow rose to fame in the 1960s as one-third of the folk trio Peter, Paul, and Mary. In addition to being a musical superstar, he has also devoted much of his energy to political activism. All three members of the trio were very involved in anti-war protests during the Vietnam era. And in the year 2000, he founded Operation Respect, designed to combat bullying. He'll be performing Friday night at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. Hello, Peter.
It's a pleasure to talk to you once again, and I'm looking forward to seeing you and your children when I come back to Iowa, one of my favorite places in the world.
How much performing are you doing these days?
Well, for Operation Respect, which is a really, it's my main work and it's my passion, I'm constantly on the road. I just got back from the Middle East, where we are now in Israel. We've just started in Jordan. We're in Palestine. And we're in many, many other countries at their request. All of them are dealing with problems of youth violence and bullying. And they know that the program, the Don't Laugh at Me program that we initiated here way back then, 15 years ago, is highly effective as a tool to create an environment in which that kind of behavior is really far less likely to occur. But I do a number, since Mary's passing, which was 4.5 years ago, I do a great many concerts by myself, which is interesting and unusual because for all those years, Peter, Paul, and Mary, we were playing very large venues, but now I'm playing relatively small ones with 300, 400, 500 people, and I love it. It's part of it is done because it pays the bills, you know, because since Mary's passing, of course, the Peter, Paul, and Mary income doesn't exist in the same way that it once did. But the other part of it is simply the joy of singing together in a fairly intimate setting with people who are singing together with me. Almost all the songs I sing are sung together with people. I invite them to join me. And to me, it's a joy and a treasure that I've always, always found very, very exciting and inspiring, and it continues to be so.
You have talked in the past about the power you think there is in people raising their voices together, in singing together. What do you think we get out of that experience?
When people sing together, they open their hearts to each other. There's a sense of intimacy and vulnerability and a connection amongst people that is remarkable. It is empowering. And it can be simply a matter of being involved in a moment of devotion together, an acknowledgement of a wedding or a memorial of some sort. But historically, just singing together to be friends, to be connected, to be loving is the way it is in summer camps, in schools, in churches, in synagogues. And when I grew up, it was everywhere, in coffee houses that were all over the place in the 1960s. But the most dramatic demonstration of its ability to bring people together is in when they're uniting to create something that will make the world a better place. Whether it's the union movement that, of course, preceded in its heyday the 1960s, or in the funk renaissance when we were singing at the marches for civil rights and then later an end to the war for women's rights. And today that continues. This experience unified and strong. In the civil rights marches, for instance, it just absolutely was a unanimous way of confirming a mutual intention. It's powerful stuff, and for me, knowing that was really the reason that I went into this field at all. It wasn't simply about the music. It was about its ability to unite people in common cause.
Do you think we sing together a lot less often than we used to?
Absolutely. That's really one of the reasons that I think some of the ability to unify our efforts to address some of the terribly challenging realities of our times has become so problematical. We don't have this tool in our culture anymore. Music, to a large degree, has been taken over by the commercial interests, and it's all run by accountants, and they want to make the biggest impact in terms of making money. It's not really devoted, as it once was, to music and music that inspires. And so, in a sense, it's hard for us to find the new Bob Dylan and to say, well, what is the blowing in the wind of the last two decades? It's not around, that everybody knows. And that absence is really not helping the movements.
When you perform, you're performing songs, some of them that you've been performing for more than 50 years. How do you keep this music fresh for you?
Whenever I perform one of these songs, if I were to perform it by myself in an empty room, it would be torture. That would be a really good way to punish me. If I'm singing it with people, and they're singing it with me, it's like a hug. You never get tired of hugging a friend or a child or a loved one. It's just always an affirmation. And I can think of no better analogy to a hug than singing songs together.
For a lot of your audience, your music is nostalgia. This is the music of their youth. But for a lot of us, this was music we grew up with as the children of those people, and our children are growing up with your music. Of course, many people know that you've done albums for children. Peter Paul and Mommy Too was a huge hit and is still selling strong and putting children to sleep and getting them excited. Did you know when you were making that album, did you understand what kind of connection your trio would have with children?
Well, we always fostered that connection, even from the get-go. And the first album, we did a song called It's Raining, It's Pouring, and Autumn to May. It's part of the... See, Peter, Paul, and Mary were known as being songs of political conscience or social conscience and concern. But equally important was the whole picture, which is love songs and work songs and children's songs. And the connection to children became apparent when we realized at a certain point that the summer camps was really the place that these songs were finding a very, very important part of their own history and home. So that evolved, but I don't think we did it with any particular intention. We were not marketing anything. We were just singing songs we loved.
Have you been surprised by how much those songs have endured?
In a way, it is surprising, because I find that Puff the Magic Dragon, which, by the way, I always sing with children on stage, and by the way, I always ask the audience to come out during the intermission and request songs for the second half, and I only do those songs in the second half, so that it's kind of a group decision as to what gets sung at that point. It did astonish me that Puff, of all the songs that we sang, seems to be still the one that is best known by everybody. That I don't understand why or how, but I sure appreciate it. And for me, particularly because my work is so focused on bringing the spirit of those songs to children through Operation Respect and the Don't Laugh at Me program, it's particularly meaningful to know that it exists.
Do you ever feel guilty that it has been making people cry for over 50 years?
Well, I've changed the ending. If you look at the book.
Yes, I've looked at the book. I still cry, yeah. Peter. I'm sorry.
Right.
Even if Puff gets a new friend, it's hard to take.
Right. Well, you just got to know that Puff is happy. He's playing with Jackie Paper's daughter. He's no longer lonely. It is sad when your friend grows up and you're no longer able to be together in the same way. But it's also, those are the realities of the life cycle. That is the joy and the glory and the sadness of our existence. And I think we all feel that special resonance when we hear Puff and we feel its message. It is sad, but life continues, and we continue through our children, and Puff will always be happy and playing with children, so we have to feel content with that.
I'm talking with Peter Yarrow, of course, one-third of the folk trio Peter, Paul, and Mary. He is performing on Friday night at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa.
Strings and sealing wax and other fancy stuff. Oh, Puff the magic dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Hanalei. Puff the magic dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking with Peter Yarrow. He's, of course, a folk singer, Peter, Paul, and Mary, such an important part of the 1960s and 70s music that still endures today. He's also a political activist, and in the year 2000, he founded the organization Operation Respect, which is designed to combat youth violence and bullying, not just in the United States, but also around the world. He'll be performing on Friday night at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. And I want to take a few minutes to take a look back. I know that you have a book coming out in the fall, in November, Peter, Paul, and Mary, 50 Years in Music. That's a book where you, Noel Paul Stuckey, and Mary all are listed as authors. And of course, she passed away several years ago. Is this something that has been in process for a long time?
We've been working on it for a couple of years. Mary had already passed, so all the new text, which is a narrative that flows through photographs. It's basically a book of photographs that traces our history and our work that we did, both musically and in terms of advocacy. But we took some pieces of writings that Mary had done while she was alive and included that. And what we did was mush it all together so that just as when we work on something together, you wouldn't know who contributed what piece, except for certain pieces that are in quotes. You know that it's a collective decision. That's the way we chose our music. That's the way we framed the way we made our statements, whether they were social, political, or whatever. And frankly, it's just at the point of being completed now, and I am extremely proud of it because it really does give you a sweeping sense of what it was that we shared. It was a glorious, glorious adventure. It was not an easy trip. There were there were many, many challenges we faced, not personally so much, because we really did love each other, and we did get along. We needed a break and after the first decade, because we were just exhausted, and the trio, being Peter or Peter, Paul, Mary, or being the members of Peter, Paul, and Mary, had preempted everything else in our lives to such a great degree that we couldn't really nurture our friends and friendships and family relationships appropriately. So we took off 7 years, and then the call went out, and we got back together for the anti-nuke movement, and realized how much we still loved each other, how much we still wanted to be together. And then we never stopped performing until the May prior to the September of Mary's passing. Until that point, even though she was wearing an oxygen mask and had oxygen tubes, and she was in a wheelchair, she insisted on continuing performing.
Wow. When the three of you first got together and started making music, when did the activism become a part of that? Because I'm sure at the start it was about the music.
No, it wasn't. It was always about activism and music. Mary and I were both steeped in the culture and tradition of the Weavers and Pete Seeger. She was a hyper-progressive from New York, grew up in Greenwich Village. Paul Robeson had sung to her as a baby. I emulated Pete Seeger and admired him. She called us properly Seeger's Raiders. And the Weavers themselves, including Pete Seeger, had always united their music with their advocacies. So right from the beginning, in the first album, we had If I Had a Hammer and Where Have All the Flowers Gone. Noel Paul was not a folk singer. He had come from the Middle West, and he loved jazz, classical music, and he had a rock and roll band. But shortly, he was really absorbed into that ethos of music as a tool for advocacy.
How often do you communicate with Noel now?
Well, we perform together from time to time. He's much more in a retirement mode than I am. He performs far less frequently, but I'm driven in a particular kind of way, and that's my nature. We also we're together constantly working on this book, you know, the Peter, Paul, Mary, 50 Years in Life and Music, and it's or Music and Life, whatever it is. He's one of my dearest friends, and of course we're together.
You also perform quite often with your daughter, right?
I do. Bethany is an amazing singer, and she and Rufus Capitocha, her musical partner, have a group that, together or with two other people, and they call that the Roots Quartet, and they just are astonishing. And when I go to Israel to perform there and to Palestine for the double concerts that I'm working on, they will be coming with me, and so will their compatriots in the Roots Quartet.
For people who haven't heard the story of how Operation Respect started, tell me where this idea came from.
Bethany heard the song Don't Laugh at Me at the Kerrville Folk Festival in Kerrville, Texas. And she said, "Dad, you have to hear this song. It's perfect for Peter, Paul, and Mary. Everybody cries." And so I went to see it, and predictably I held her hand, and I shed tears. It was so powerful and moving, written by Steve Seskin and sung by him there at the Kerrville Folk Festival, written by him and Alan Shamblin. And then I brought it to the group, and we sat around shedding a tear and talking about how we had responded to childhood cruelty that we had seen around us, and how we, as fairly sensitive human beings, which is not uncommon for people who are creative, had responded to that kind of cruelty. So when we got on stage, we were not singing just a song about somebody with whom we empathized. We were also telling our own story.
I'm a little boy with glasses, the one they call a geek. A little girl who never smiles, 'cause I got braces on my teeth. And I know how it feels to cry myself to sleep. I'm that kid on every playground who's always chosen last. A single teenage mother trying to overcome my past. You don't have to be my friend, but is it too much to ask? Don't laugh at me, don't call me names, don't get your plans.
Sure, I brought it to them with the intention of creating the program, because I realized when I heard that song that I had found, the We Shall Overcome, or Blowing in the Wind, or If I Had a Hammer, of a movement to address the need for compassion and empathy, and the need to address cruelty and ridicule and bullying in youth. And this was over a year prior to the tragedy of the shootings in Columbine High School.
You talk about having experienced that as a child. It's something that a lot of people, unfortunately, have gone through. And it was prior to the shootings at Columbine. I mean, was there something specifically that you were seeing in the news or experiences that people were telling you about that made you think that was the moment where this was really needed, that this was where your energy should be placed for the future?
Well, you know, my mother was a school teacher. I was keenly aware of the shifting of the kind of culture of kindness to a culture of greater disrespect, and I felt it just in my lifetime as I was seeing what was going on. And furthermore, I realized that as adults, we're not really all that malleable, and that we needed, if we were to regain the sense of humanity that we need to now, which is crucial, and the sense of compassion and empathy, we have to nurture a next generation that does not emulate this breakdown of heart that we are observing. And it's not just among children at all. I mean, it's on television, in the reality shows where ridicule is a sport, and it's in Congress, it's everywhere. We live in a society whose greatest danger to us is this alteration of our perspective from one of humanity and caring and thinking about us together to one in which we are focused on materialism, we are focused on me versus everybody else, and a perspective that makes us blind to the great gifts of life, which come from a we perspective rather than a me perspective.
This movement started with a song. It became an organization, and you've worked with many others to develop a curriculum for people, educators, to use in schools. And as you mentioned earlier, it's become an international program as well. You're doing so much work with the program to travel around the world and perform and meet with children, but you're not in a position, I would guess, to really develop a relationship with the kids. Do you get to see the changes that take place?
Well, I actually do, because, you know, I don't do it constantly, but I do go into the schools from time to time, and I see how this works, and I'm always moved deeply by it. It's amazing, and it's part of my life, and I'm hardly apart from it. Now, we're in 22,000 schools. I'm not going to be able to go to even the tiniest portion of them, but I'm enough in them that I can be part legitimately of creating the next evolutions of the curriculum, which we're constantly working on.
Is there a personal experience you've had in visiting one of these schools that you draw on for motivation on those days when you're tired of getting on a plane?
Well, my motivation is constant, and it's not just about kids. It's about the world, as I said. It's about the existence of empathy in adults as well as children. But there are things that happen all the time that are extraordinary. For instance, there was when I was in Ukraine at a special appearance before four schools, kids had come from all over Ukraine, some of them traveling 12, 14 hours, and they all sang the song Don't Laugh at Me in Ukrainian. And then I went on stage and I sang it in English, and they joined me in English to the degree they knew it. And then I did This Little Light of Mine, and I explained that. And then I asked one of the girls, we had across the stage, we had the kids that had traveled all those distances. One of the girls, they said, what is it that you, what is your little light that you would like people to see that, that tells them something that they might not know about you that's really special in your heart? And she just burst into tears, and she said, I just wish they could see me as I am and understand me. And everybody just fell apart. It was so moving. And from that point on, everybody wore their heart on their sleeve. And this, there was another instance where I was in New Jersey, and I was making a presentation. And at the end of it, I asked for the kids to come up and comment and talk about what had come up from them. And three boys got on stage, and they said, they were all wearing the same shirt, and they had their leader, and he said, we know we've been doing this, and we're not going to do it anymore, and we want to tell the girl who was just crying that we really feel sorry. And the person who was in the school as the Don't Laugh at Me organizer, and she was a social worker, was just in tears. I mean, to see kids go through this, this happens constantly. Kids are ready. They don't know, a lot of them don't know what they're doing when they're acting this way. They don't know they have an option, and they've seen adults act this way. And when they realize that unanimously they don't want this in their lives, then you see very dramatic events occur.
To do what you do, you clearly must have a lot of hope. But at the same time, you've been doing this for a very long time, and the news can get very discouraging. How do you maintain your hope?
Every time I sing, and I see people singing with me, and I see the excitement in their hearts and their eyes, I'm inspired. I know it's within us to do this. We as people are not the problem. The media, the messages, the faulted leadership, these are perverting our perspectives. We have this capacity to reach out for each other. And we need to give each other permission to be the kind of people that I think can really make a humane world. And every time I sing with people, that idea and that feeling and that conviction gets reconfirmed.
Peter Yarrow, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Peter Yarrow will be performing at the Englert Theater in Iowa City on Friday night. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about a new app designed to help those with the language disorder, aphasia.
Time passing, where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago, where have all the flowers gone?
Young girls have picked them every
This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.